You don't stop the snapback, which goes away in just a few weeks. You cannot trigger this again after October. It's done. Iran just wins all of these strategic gains forever. Whatever games they're playing with Rafael Grossi at the IAEA are irrelevant distractions. You have to complete the snapback because you don't get another chance at it.
Hello and welcome to the Miskav Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons, the podcast for anyone who wants to truly understand what is happening in the Middle East beyond the headlines and spin. The Miskav Institute is Israel's leading national security policy center dedicated to strengthening Israel's security, regional integration, and international alliances. I'm Lahav Harkov, your co-host, a Miskav Institute senior fellow and senior political correspondent for Jewish Insider. My co-host, Asher Fredman, Miskav Institute Executive Director and a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation, is traveling this week, so it's just me. Each week, Asher and I bring you fresh insights not only into the most critical developments in Israel and the Middle East, but also key updates on the most important trends and opportunities taking shape in this incredible region. Please subscribe and follow wherever you listen to your podcast to keep up to date and ahead of the curve on everything connected to the Middle East. You can reach out to us with comments and suggestions at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. We read and respond to all of your comments. This is normally where Asher and I would have a conversation, and there certainly have been a lot of noteworthy events since we recorded last week's episode. There was the Israeli strike aiming at Hamas leaders in Qatar, and we're still not sure which of Hamas leaders, if any, were actually hit in that strike. There was Secretary of State Marco Rubio's visit to Israel, and Prime Minister Netanyahu's remarks about Israel building up its defense industry to push back against European boycotts, but his use of the terms Sparta and autarky, which caused some panic in the markets here in Israel. But rather than have a long monologue from me, I will refer you to my reporting on all of those topics at jewishinsider.com. And instead, we will go straight to a guest who will prepare us for what may be one of the biggest stories in the coming weeks, snapback sanctions finally being applied to Iran. Our guest, Richard Goldberg, was the Trump administration's National Energy Dominance Council senior counselor and a senior advisor at the U.S. Department of the Interior until August of this year. And he is now a senior advisor at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. In the first Trump administration, he was the director for countering Iranian weapons of mass destruction, and he is a top-notch sanctions expert. So get ready for a really fascinating interview where we're going to talk about what snapback sanctions mean, how they work, how they're expected to damage Iran's economy, and we'll also talk a bit about why the Trump administration just can't quit Qatar. Hi, Rich. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
We're recording just a couple weeks before snapback sanctions are supposed to happen, in theory. And I was hoping you could explain to our listeners where exactly we are in the process. So from what I understand, the permanent members of the UN Security Council theoretically could stop snapback at any time before the end of the month. So what's going on now?
That's right. So the Security Council resolution that was enacted alongside the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal back in 2015, set out all kinds of parameters for the years to come. We saw many of them happen already. In 2020, the conventional arms embargo went away on Iran. That was scheduled to happen as one of these sunsets under the deal. That was a Security Council restriction previously on Iran. It went away under this new resolution 2231. 2023 rolls around into the Biden administration, the missile embargo goes away. Well, another one of these sunsets was snapback itself, and snapback as a procedure baked into the resolution. This was part of the negotiation, and this was part of the marketing sale to Congress and to the American people by John Kerry and Barack Obama at the time, saying, hey, if Iran violates the deal at any time, we can just bring back all of the sanctions from the United Nations in addition to U.S. sanctions. And everything that they might be gaining over the out years can just go away magically. And the way that that happens is described in the resolution itself. Somebody who is a participant in the JCPOA, And that's defined as a number of the countries who you know, were part of the agreement back in 2015. And if they send a letter to the Security Council saying that Iran is in significant non-performance of its nuclear commitments under the JCPOA, that starts a 30-day clock. And what happens is, after day 10, if no other member of the Security Council has stepped in to say, hey, we don't want this to happen, even if Iran's in violation or we disagree that there's a violation, we want to keep the deal going. We don't want to have this the so-called snapback occurring at the end of 30 days. They could put a resolution forward to the Security Council that has to be affirmatively voted on and passed to say, we're not going to do the snapback. We're actually going to keep the status quo, keep all the benefits to Iran, keep the JCPOA as enshrined in the Security Council going into the out years. If at that day 10, the Russians haven't done that, the Chinese haven't done that, the Iranians themselves haven't done that, or one of the European members, the United States, hasn't done that, the president of the Security Council, today that's South Korea, has to put forward such a resolution, and that resolution is supposed to be voted on. It shall be voted on by the Security Council within that 30-day period. Well, on day 10, South Korea did submit such a resolution. It's ready to go, ready to be voted on. It hasn't been voted on yet. At some point, I expect the U.S., the E3, that's the U.K., France, and Germany, who have triggered the snapback in this case. They are the ones who sent the letter to the Security Council under the procedure. They will ask for the vote on the South Korean resolution. The South Koreans will then put it forward to the Council, and it needs to pass before the 30 days are up. What does it mean to pass? It means to either get a majority and no permanent member vetoes it, or it's done. If it doesn't get a majority of the votes, or if the United States, France, the United Kingdom use their veto, it's also done. So it has to affirmatively pass. The onus is on the Iranians or the Russians or the Chinese to try to overcome a U.S. or European veto and block this resolution by passing it, amazingly. It's sort of a reverse psychology. So we have all the cards. The Europeans have all the cards. If at the end of 30 days, for some reason, there isn't a vote, which, by the way, happened the last time around we saw this movie, people may forget, in 2020, 5 years ago, the Trump administration tried to do this. At the time, the Europeans sided with the Iranians, sided with the Russians and Chinese, and said, well, hey, you know, you're no longer a JCPOA participant. You left the deal. So we think you lost the right to issue the snapback. We disagreed in the Trump administration. We said, just read the deal. You know, if anybody's ever read a contract or a legal document and you define a term somewhere and you put in parentheses, this is what the term means. And the document says JCPOA participant and says the United States is always defined as such. We can do this. They said, no, that's maybe the letter of the law, but not the spirit of the law. We're not going to do that. So we went a full 30 days last time from August of 2020, having triggered the snapback, and nobody did anything. No resolutions, no votes. And at the end of the 30 days, the Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians, the Europeans all said no snapback occurred. The Trump administration declared, hey, snapback has occurred. You were supposed to pass a resolution to stop it. You never did. This time around, it's different. The Europeans are the ones pushing the snapback 5 years later. It's their snapback triggering. The South Koreans, the president of the Security Council this time, has tabled a resolution. That didn't happen last time. So the process does appear to be unfolding by the book, if you will. And then at the end of the 30 days, once that resolution has been voted on, and that's coming up very soon, and does not pass the Security Council, what is supposed to happen is that resolution that governed the JCPOA, that governed snapback, all these things, it just sort of self-destructs. It's gone. It goes away from being on the website, from being in existence on any legal documents. And all of the previous resolutions going back to 2010 and prior that were putting sanctions on Iran because of its nuclear and nuclear-capable missile programs will come back into force. So that missile embargo comes back, the conventional arms embargo comes back, zero enrichment, zero reprocessing as standards come back, and supposed to be a sanctions committee as well under the previous resolutions that gets reestablished. So that means we'll get through this 30-day period. We should have followed everything by the book. The Europeans should declare that snapback has occurred. We should be declaring snapback has occurred in the United States. Most nations will need to go along with that. That will appear to be the consensus. The outlier will be the Chinese and the Russians who may object. And then it's on the Secretariat, the UN staff, the Secretary General, and everybody else working there to change the website, to reconstitute the committee, to actually do the things that need to happen to roll back to the previous sanctions regime. And that will be the next test to see if the Russians or Chinese exert some kind of pressure, if some reason Guterres, you know, instructs somebody not to do it. But I expect it will occur at this point.
But Iran also has been like exerting pressure within the International Atomic Energy Agency, right? So my understanding is that they're now the vice chair. And so, I mean, what do we... At this point, we're not even 100% sure what was destroyed in the 12-day war, even though it's safe to assume a lot was destroyed.
Yeah.
How are we going to be able to know exactly what's going on there?
Well, you know, Iran obviously is still a member of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, the NPT. You know, they're a member of the IAEA. They go to the meetings. They've been elected, as you say, to the General Conference as vice chair. That's meeting right now. A wild, wild thing for that to happen. But only in the United Nations can such a thing occur, of course.
But it's just like, you know, Libya and Iran and Saudi Arabia being on like the Women's Rights Committee and things like that.
That's right. So there's a reality and then there is a potential reality. And we have to think about both at the moment. Iran, as a member of the NPT, has a comprehensive safeguards agreement with the IAEA. That is the basic commitment obligation they have to allow the most basic safeguards inspections regime that all members of the NPT are supposed to submit to. We like and we encourage members to adopt additional protocols to their safeguards agreement. You've heard this term before. So people are really in the weeds. I've heard about the additional protocol and that Iran had agreed to implement the additional protocol as part of the JCPOA. They have since rolled back various elements of those commitments as part of their abrogation of the JCPOA. This has to do with sort of snap inspections and more intrusive videotaping and monitoring going on at more sites than you would think about across a supply chain and value chain within a nuclear industry. So a lot of that has been curtailed. By the way, that's not new. That's not under the Trump administration. It's not in response to the 12-day war. They started rolling that back under Joe Biden in 2021, starting to kick inspectors out of certain facilities, withhold recordings from the IAEA from certain facilities, started denying visas to like a third of the inspectors, all the most senior ones who know what they're doing. That was going on throughout the 4 years of the Biden administration. And now we have this reality check, which is, Where exactly would these inspectors be going? These are facilities that are largely under rubble, heavily degraded or destroyed, maybe nuclear material trapped down somewhere that nobody can really get to at this point, maybe not, maybe all destroyed radioactive sites. So what exactly the job of the inspectors would be at the primary former enrichment sites is sort of a question mark. You'd be trying to look at what are they doing there and what's the, if there's any reconstitution efforts going on, you'd be documenting. So that's important if you could get people on the ground. Some of the, you know, midstream or maybe say upstream parts of the enrichment program, the enrichment facilities, if they try to reconstitute manufacturing, what is going on in their raw materials area where they're mining and milling, the actual uranium. You know, those parts would be interesting to monitor as well if you could get more people on the ground. But largely the major threat, the reporting that the IAEA was doing on a quarterly basis of here's where the stockpile stands, here's how much enriched uranium they have today of various quantities, that's not going to happen for the foreseeable future because all those stockpiles and the materials and the facilities are either heavily degraded or destroyed. So that's today. That's, I guess, good news in a today scenario where the IAEA withholds inspections. But we should expect them to reconstitute or attempt to reconstitute. And in the years ahead, you know, the question mark is, how are you detecting reconstitution? How are you detecting certain activities to be able to interdict them, to be able to say, hey, you know, President Trump has a doctrine now of no reconstitution. How will that be enforced exactly? So that will have to rely on Western intelligence services between Israel, the United States, partners and allies, and whatever else the IAEA can glean on its own from visits and tours that the Iranians allow. Now, you're right. Iran has made threats about what else it might do in response to the snapback. These threats have changed over time, and they're changing today based on what they can threaten. During the Biden years, the threat that they made deterred people like Jake Sullivan, and you heard it out of his mouth, they were very scared in the White House that Iran would enrich uranium to 90% weapons grade as a response to the snapback. Now, obviously, that simply guaranteed that at some point they would enrich uranium to 90%, because if you're afraid of a political move at the Security Council prompting a nuclear breakout, my God, you'll never use military action for such a thing. But be that as it may, that's where it was. They've also in the past threatened to pull themselves out of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, a la North Korea. They could still threaten to do that. Be a little awkward now as they've been elected vice chair of the General Conference. You imagine that they do value the veneer of legitimacy. I think that's why they fear the snapback so much and they have fought it so much. It's a bizarre thing in regimes like Iran, even Russia, China, even though they flout international law, conduct illicit activity, make a mockery of the international institutions which we have founded and still care about, they actually try to use them to create their own sense and source of legitimacy. And so a Security Council resolution that has their back, that has their side, is really valuable to them because it contorts, it forces the Europeans to contort themselves, you know, of like, well, it is a Security Council resolution. Well, they are the vice chair of this IAEA institution, and so we have to respect that. And I think it's almost funny to them how Western folks will take what is supposed to be legitimacy for illegitimate actors and respect the legitimacy of it. Therefore, they yearn that legitimacy to insulate themselves from further pressure from good actors. And so, you know, we will see here. Do they value being in the NPT? I think they do. Even if they don't comply with the NPT, the idea that they would then leave the NPT leaves them with less legitimacy in their own propaganda. And so, again, could they do these things? Sure. What exactly would they do in the short term to be provocative? Not that much, given the 12-day war and the result of the B-2 bombers. But we should be worried long term about reconstitution efforts, and therefore, we should obviously be pushing them to accept inspections, robust verification, and dismantlement of anything that is left over. Because let's be honest, I think we should, you know, believe that at least in the weaponization aspects, there are things we still didn't know about potentially. There are still activities, people, places that still exist. The nuclear capable missile program obviously still has infrastructure and could be threatening, and there will be reconstitution in other areas and maybe foreign actors that come in to help them as well. So
on that topic, yeah. I was on a speaking tour in August, and I talked a lot about the Iran war. And I gave this talk a few times, and every time I said that I really hope the Europeans do snapback. So I'm glad they did. But the question a lot of people asked me, and I admit that I didn't have a great answer for it, so maybe you do, is how much will sanctions really impact Iran when, first of all, the West has kept its sanctions on Iran, right, beyond even when the UN sanctions didn't exist. And so they've done things to try to sort of strengthen their economy. They call it the resistance economy, right? They sell to Russia and to China. So are these sanctions really going to cripple them? Are they going to have a big effect?
So here's a couple of answers here. I think there are strategic reasons why this is very helpful, and there's an unknown financial economic impact hanging over, which I think we'll see play out as well. The first one, and by the way, for the first one here especially, I think really important for everything we just said about what Iran could threaten to do and maybe cut some deals with the IAEA, if we know we'll let more inspectors in. The Europeans, United States, should not be distracted by any negotiation going on between Iran and the IAEA over Iran's ongoing illicit conduct. they're not coming clean. If they came clean, if they said, hey, we're an open kimono, we're going to tell you all about the nuclear weapons program, you can come in, you can dismantle everything, you know, full verification, et cetera. Okay, you know, we're in a totally different world, different ballgame. But right now, you know, negotiating over, I'll take two inspectors instead of three inspectors, and you can have this video camera instead of that video camera. You don't stop the snapback, which goes away in just a few weeks, right? It's gone. It sunsets under the resolution. You cannot trigger this again after October. It's done. Iran just wins all of these strategic gains forever. So whatever games they're playing with Rafael Grossi at the IAEA are irrelevant distractions. You have to complete the snapback because you don't get another chance at it. And we know this regime is weaker than ever. They can threaten all they want. They can protest all they want. Their hand is gone. They do not have the leverage here. So complete the snapback for two important reasons. Number one, on a strategic level, they will in fact no longer have any claim of legitimacy to transfer those weapons to Russia. When they send a drone to Russia, when they send a short-range ballistic missile to Russia, technically the Russians today will tell you that is fully legal under the Security Council, which is true. It may violate U.S. sanctions or European sanctions. It might be disgusting to us. We have lifted at the Security Council under this resolution both the conventional arms embargo and the missile embargo, which means transferring in and out of those systems, in most cases, including to Russia, is legitimate at the Security Council. That will be gone after the snapback is completed. So that's a big deal. It also is a big deal for all foreign partners, all foreign governments, adversaries, members of the United Nations, who may think about assisting Iran in reconstituting its nuclear program, its enrichment activities, its reprocessing activities, its missile activities, will all be prohibited and illegitimate under the Security Council. Again, going back to 2015, that kind of work became legitimate because their nuclear program became legitimate and their missile program became legitimate. All of that goes away. So from an international isolation, from a legitimacy perspective, I think important for the Europeans, important on a bipartisan basis in the United States to be able to say to Russia, to China, to other actors, Bolivia, whoever it is, you are in violation of a Security Council resolution and we're going to hold you accountable. We're going to feature you at a Security Council meeting. Now, you could say, what does it matter? It's a Security Council. It's a kangaroo circus. We have sanctions already. We have a president who's willing to use military force. I don't disagree with a lot of that, except for the fact that we see it that way and not the rest of the world. And there are a lot of countries that do believe in the Security Council is it. You know, I get, you know, America has this president right now and has this policy, but the next president will be AOC, or the next president will be, you know, Kamala Harris or whoever. And then maybe there aren't sanctions. Maybe there are. Maybe there's a different view of the Security Council as king over American law. So it matters. It matters in how we operate in the international arena long term. Secondly, I think it really matters economically and financially to the regime. And I think it's one of the reasons why they fought this so hard, because ultimately this resolution that has still been sitting there to this day, that is about to be destroyed by the snapback, is the JCPOA. Right? It is the last remnants. It's the legal framework. It is the enactment of the JCPOA into international law. And so while we all have these conversations, you know, there's been a 12-day war, there's been destruction, the JCPOA is alive, right? It's just been on life support in this hospital bed and waiting for a new president of the United States to change policy, waiting for something to happen to revive it. And use this body and win all these strategic gains and get to 2031 when they're allowed any level of enrichment under the Security Council resolution and have this legitimized pathway to nuclear weapons all alongside this hope that the full JCPOA will come back. Well, even if you don't believe that is likely to happen, even if you believe it's never going to come back, there is no Iran nuclear deal, etc., there is the possibility. How do we know? Because Joe Biden spent 4 years trying to get back to it and never triggered the snapback because of that. and they wanted to go back to something like the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. They let Iran advance to the nuclear finish line because of that view, and it is still an ideologically closely held belief in wide swaths of the Democratic Party to go back to the JCPOA, and that Donald Trump, to this day, was wrong to get out of it. They say that out of their mouths every day. So if you're the Iranians, if you're the market in Iran, there is something still holding up the economy a little bit. There is something still underneath what could be bottom. And so I don't know exactly what will happen. You have seen the rial go back into free fall since snapback was triggered. That means there's instability again. There's uncertainty again. Once snapback happens and all the international resolutions come back on and there is no hope of JCPOA coming off, you know, back to life from life support, like the patient is dead, like we're sitting Shiva, it is over. I think that is an unpredictable reality for the regime, for its economy and financial stability, with all caveats being that there is no actual financial sanctions in the UN resolutions, right? There is potential economic impact, second tier, third tier, extrapolated from various trade in parts and components and, you know, nuclear program, et cetera. But you know, not like bank sanctions and things like that. You know, there are asset freezes that need to come back on individuals, things like that, but not total sector-wide and economy-wide. Mm-hmm. But that narrative economic impact of the bottom falling out, I think we'll see a little bit from the outside, and I think a lot of things will be happening on the inside.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio was in Israel this week, and when he talked about Iran, he talked about medium-range missiles that Iran is developing that can reach Europe. And we know, of course, that they have missiles that can reach Israel because many of them did during the 12-day war. In what way does snapback, if it does, address this missile threat? And if it doesn't, then what needs to be done to address that?
It does. Again, this is the Security Council. It's about legitimacy. It's about international actors supporting the program in any way, and also about legitimacy of Iran conducting any R&D testing launches on its missile program. All of that becomes illicit once again. Today, it's actually illicit, not just because of the embargo lifting, which means components can come into Iran and be transferred in. Technology can be provided to Iran since the missile embargo went away, and potential applications from the advanced conventional arms embargo also having gone away previously. But you also have a complete ban on missile testing under the UN Security Council resolution that had been given away in the JCPOA and diluted to calls upon Iran not to conduct tests, research and tests on nuclear-capable missiles. So I do think it hits the missile arena from an international law perspective very effectively. Has to be backed up by our own willingness not just to enforce sanctions, but potential military interdictions as well. And I think this should be very worrisome still. We know that Iran's stockpile is not drained. Okay, so we should understand that as we sit here today and we debate the status of the nuclear program and, you know, how obliterated are some of these sites, how many years have they been set back in their nuclear weapons capability, understand that their ability to deliver very advanced heavy warheads with precision, as we saw during the 12-day war, still exists. And while we don't have a public number identifying how many exactly they have of medium-range ballistic missiles or intermediate-range ballistic missiles, the fact that we know they continue to work on their intercontinental ballistic missile program, not just to hit Europe now, but to hit the continental United States, it's always been their endeavor, and they've continued a space launch vehicle program to try to help them get there, because that is just a cover for an ICBM program. This is continuing to be a worrisome aspect. Now, is it as potentially existential as the nuclear threat if these missiles were tipped with a nuclear warhead? Of course, not as existential. Does that mean a salvo of 100 missiles can't do enormous damage if the person who's receiving those, the country that's receiving those missiles, is not prepared for it, doesn't have enough interceptors for it, fails to intercept? Of course, that can cause mass destruction and casualties. So we have to be continuing to be concerned about the missile threat. Projects like Golden Dome for the United States continue to be relevant from North Korea, from China, Russia, and long-term still Iran, especially if they continue to try to reconstitute the manufacturing and R&D. And then the cooperation that the United States and Israel has on missile defense really is the game-changing aspect of the last couple of years. When you think about Iran crossing the Rubicon, making the strategic calculation that it could start attacking the state of Israel with ballistic missiles, that decision ultimately leads to the destruction of their nuclear program. That was a grave miscalculation. Either a misunderstanding or a lack of faith in how well U.S.-Israel joint missile defense technology would prove effective, and it did. Now, it's not just the Arrow system, which obviously without Arrow, there's a lot more destruction, but, the ability of, the willingness of a president of the United States to park five guided missile destroyers off the coast of Israel in the Eastern Mediterranean is itself a historic moment that, I don't know if we'll ever see again. Hopefully we won't have to ever see again. But if Iran decides, it's feeling lucky again and wants to send a few hundred more missiles over if they still have them, you may need that augmented missile defense for Israel once again. The THAAD missile system from the United States as well. All of these in play at the same time for just the sheer volume of numbers that Iran was volleying. That's a lot of interceptors used by the United States and by Israel. And so right now is a very good time to reload as fast as possible, I would say, because the enemy still has missiles and there may still be targets left on the nuclear or missile side that are borderline, if not existential in nature, to be removed in a round two one day and maybe a one day soon. And you're going to have a full stock of interceptors and coordination and support from the United States before any such operation, to make sure you defend against that missile threat again.
And we should say that you played a very important role in expanding the U.S.-Israel missile defense cooperation and funding for the Arrow and the Iron Dome. I would imagine it turned out the way you had hoped.
One of the most proudest things I've ever done in my life. Now looking back, I always sort of believed it was a hypothetical, and we talked about it. My old boss, Mark Kirk, 15, 17 years ago, when we were talking about moving an X-band radar to the Negev Desert to plug in to Arrow and to just completely expand and revolutionize the scope of U.S.-Israel missile defense cooperation. We were, fighting for more funding on Arrow 3, upper-tier intercept capabilities. I mean, all of this seemed like it was just never going to happen. I will admit, I was asked to do a seminar for high school students for the Tikva Institute earlier in the war. Somebody's going to finally look up this program somewhere, I realized. And I was asked to explain missile defense to hundreds, thousands of kids around the country in the U.S. At the outset of the war. And I took them through the entire layered air defense that Israel has and all the different programs from Iron Dome, David Sling, Arrow 2, Arrow 3, then, intercepts by air for, with aircraft, all the different things. And when I got to Arrow, I sort of said, and I don't think you'll see this in use, said at the time, but if there ever are ballistic missiles thrown in the air, I think I did it right before the Houthis had kicked off their first missile attack, a month into the war. I said, you won't see this probably, but if you do, this is how Arrow works, etc. And then I saw Arrow in use now, and I said, wow. And then once the Iranian attack started happening, I was like, wow, I cannot believe this is really happening. And to see the effectiveness of the Arrow system and all the, and by the way, it's not me or Mark Kirk or other, I mean, so many heroes who championed in the U.S. Congress and the Senate and the House for many years, sometimes against budget cut requests from various administrations on a bipartisan basis, pushing against bureaucracy in the U.S. and in Israel, by the way, that were resistant to some expansions in this cooperation for sovereignty concerns, things like that, to now look back on all that work so many years ago and the path we sort of set our two countries on to keep exercising it and being ready for it and to actually happen in real life and save countless lives in Israel and change the path of the war is remarkable.
Well, I mean, the people of Israel, they don't even know they should be thanking you, probably most of them, but thank you. I mean, thanks to the work of you and others, we're still here today. I want to ask you about one of Iran's neighbors, Qatar, which right now is very angry at Israel. They gathered this whole conference of Arab leaders. I heard something very interesting that Rubio said in his press conference with Netanyahu earlier this week. So I want to read back this quote to you. He says, "We're focused on what happens next," meaning after Israel tried to strike the Hamas leaders in Doha, and we still aren't fully sure of what the results are. He says, "What role Qatar can play in reaching an outcome here, not just end of hostilities, freeing hostages, disarmament, but also a better future for the people of Gaza. We are going to continue to encourage Qatar to play a constructive role in that regard." Now, it didn't surprise me that the U.S. wants the Qataris to continue helping mediate the negotiations with Hamas, because nobody else has effectively been able to play that role, even though the Qataris could do a better job. But what really struck me when I was listening to that at the press conference was that he said they're going to be involved in the better future for the people of Gaza. What is it about, I mean, and it's not just the U.S., it's not just the Trump administration, but that's where you have better insight. Why can't they quit Qatar? Why do they think that Qatar is a constructive player for the future?
I will put two realities down on the table that I think from a bipartisan basis and from just realities of markets and defense and U.S. interests do play a role, but perhaps we decide that they play an outsized role, plus their influence efforts make them, you know, at least appear at times to be invulnerable from pressure despite bad actions. Number one, they host a major artery of the U.S. military in Al Udeid Air Base there. The Combined Air Operations Center really coordinates a lot, if not all, of our air operations in the region. We base a lot of key assets there that need to be potentially moved to different theaters, different points. Now, you could just have a different base. It would take time. It would take a little bit of money, which another Gulf ally might pay for. I mean, you could just move all this to Saudi Arabia or to the UAE. Or you could say, hey, this is the base that just came under missile attack from Iran at the end of the 12-day war. Why do we have one of the most important bases right across the Persian Gulf, you know, from Iran and within missile range? Maybe we shouldn't have critical assets, you know, right there. And from our own security reason, we should think about how we start moving out of Al Udeid. But the Pentagon doesn't think that way normally. You know, this is just how they do business, and it would be too hard to think about something else. And, you know, they're great partners for hosting us. And so, you know, life goes on there, and the DOD always goes to bat for the Qataris on the base. Similar, by the way, dynamic that has occurred over many years with Turkey. And then the second piece here, which I think does have increasing influence, is their dominance in the liquefied natural gas market and natural gas market in general. You know, this is a country that could be defined as a gas station with a television station. And so they do have a lot of partnerships with U.S. energy firms. They have investments in the U.S. in energy. We have various joint ventures. Different plays as the American LNG industry has come into full flourish. But we're also a competitor with the Qataris, which I think is a dynamic that hasn't been explored enough in the Trump administration because, you know, the president wants to make America energy dominant. He wants Europe to buy American LNG more than Qatari LNG. He wants to make sure European regulations don't put U.S. LNG producers at a disadvantage while giving different treatment potentially to a Qatari government that, you know, buys off European legislators and bribes to get the FIFA games and things like that. So I think if you actually started unpacking the energy relationship a little more in the energy competition world, you would both find an interdependence, but also a competition that needs more examination. So that's that piece of it. Obviously, they have invested tons and tons of money in people, both sides of the aisle, putting them on the payroll over the years. Some of them are in the cabinet today. I don't think they're bad people. By the way, I don't even think that they agree with the Qataris hosting Hamas or sponsoring Hamas. And I think that they would probably at some point indict the Hamas people and force their extradition back to the United States from Qatar. But, you know, when you're in the private sector and this isn't, you know, your number one thing that you're thinking about, and somebody comes to you and says, hey, want to make $100,000? Want to make $1 million? We'll put you on the roll. You'll just do things that are, you know, for FIFA World Cup or whatever. And now they have this network that they've cultivated, and you've met them, and they're nice, and they're wonderful, and they're, how could they be Hamas people? Like, I don't know. When they do real estate deals with people, and they cultivate relationships. So their tentacles are everywhere, in addition to the higher education spending we talk about, buying sports teams, investing in critical infrastructure, that, you know, the state of South Carolina.
And, of course, Al Jazeera.
Al Jazeera, yeah. But state of South Carolina is hugely dependently economically reliant on Qatar. Right. And do you think they just pick South Carolina for no reason? There's a reason they pick South Carolina. And I won't go into
the reason being Senator Lindsey Graham,
who is an incredibly strong ally and voice and expert in national security, with a reality of the Qatari presence in South Carolina.
Right.
And probably a different impression of the Qataris than I have, not having that economic relationship and seeing that in my state. So yes, I it's not a criticism of the people, just to be clear here. It's an examination of the influence network and how the Qataris operate and how they become insulated in this regard. It's very sophisticated. It's very, you know, long-term thinking. And by the way, I will tell you this, there is also a line of thinking that goes around that, there is a generational divide, similar to a generational divide in Saudi Arabia. You know, why isn't there normalization with Israel right now? Well, you know, the king is not dead in Saudi Arabia. Crown prince is still the crown prince. Maybe that will happen still when, you know, while the crown prince is still a crown prince, maybe not. There's a similar type of, you know, behind the scenes whisper campaign that the younger Al-Thani doesn't agree with the sponsorship of the Muslim Brotherhood, doesn't want to see Qatar the way it is today, doesn't want to be hosting Hamas, but the elders do. The elders are still committed to the ideological cause, or at least the belief of playing all sides.
His mother sure is. I don't know if you've ever looked at the Instagram of Sheikh Hamosa, but it's like Hamas propaganda.
Oh, yeah.
100%.
Yeah. So there's this belief that once that generation is gone, suddenly, you know, the younger generation will just be like, yeah, we want normalization with Israel too. We're not with the Muslim Brotherhood. Do I believe that? Not so sure. So that is the reality we face here. Now, I will say one thing. For all of their investment in people and in the economy and in higher education and, you know, all the stuff, and come here, we're going to throw money at you, and, oh, President Trump, we love you, here's a 747. You know, that was a genius idea. Like, it will just give you a 747. Like MBS never had that thought. That's crazy. But you know what? In the end, anybody who's out there for a moment who ever believed that the United States had no idea Israel was about to do what it did in Doha, give me a break. You are either so stupid or you're a willful idiot that you would believe, you know, any sort of news report that, oh, it's just shocking. Oh, people.
I mean,
are so
one of those news reporters, and I'm going to be the one to not name names this time because it's someone I know. He first reported Israel didn't tell, or that Israel only told President Trump at the last minute. And then 3-4 days later, he reported, oh, no, Israel warned the U.S. far in advance. And I was like, of course Israel did, because what are there, no missile defense, air defense systems on the Al Udeid base? Like,
of course.
You'd have to be an idiot to think the U.S. didn't know.
The U.S. owns the airspace. It would need to deconflict with the Israelis in advance. Otherwise, you'd have a major problem. You'd also just have a major problem because there's a U.S. airbase right there. There's U.S. personnel on the ground. You don't know where they are. You know, it's a U.S. Major non-NATO ally. It's central in the negotiations. It's central right now, whether I agree with that or not. It is central in the negotiations over Gaza. It's the focus of the President of the United States a lot of this time. What, you wouldn't surprise him like that. They didn't do it on Iran, and they didn't do it here either. That was obvious from the beginning. And if you read the president's very carefully crafted statement, he never said he never talked to Netanyahu before that morning. He never said it was the first time he heard about an attack. He just matter-of-factly gave a TikTok of the day I was notified by the U.S. military, the Israeli military were attacking shortly before the attack, and I told Witkoff, blah, 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 blah. He doesn't say what happened yesterday. He doesn't say what happened over the weekend or last week, right? He leaves that out. So that was pretty obvious. He didn't say a blanket statement. I have never had knowledge of this. We have had no knowledge of this prior to this, right? He didn't say that on purpose because, of course, he had knowledge of it because the Netanyahu would be like literally crazy to do that. And the reaction of the United States, absent that coordination, would have been far more severe than what you saw. What you're seeing is trying to placate the Qataris because they're freaking out and the U.S. needs to keep them quiet for whatever they think that's important. So that's my view of things there. But yes, you know, that initial reporting went viral. Additional reporting started coming out of saying, oh, people in the White House are really upset. Senior officials, you know, how many senior officials have been upset with Israel for so long over Iran and this and that? Never confirmed, never supported by the words and statements of the President of the United States himself when he finally speaks, or of senior leaders like Marco Rubio. And in the end, you start seeing news articles. I saw the Wall Street Journal had a piece. I mean, it might have been the most atrocious one and insidious one I've seen in a long time. Some of them very senior, longtime reporters I've respected. It's all about Netanyahu and Putin are testing Trump.
I missed that one, but that is a very strange take. Like, what is the logic?
Well, Qatar happened, and incursions of airspace in Poland and other areas of Eastern Europe are happening. And the president is supposedly doing nothing about it. He's placating Netanyahu, and he's placating Putin, right? And so there's like multiple outrages in this. First of all, the entire frame is just to be anti-Trump. That's the motivation here. But then the subplot is Putin and Netanyahu are the same kind of person. Russia and Israel are going to be comparable in this situation. And whatever reaction and what's playing out between the U.S. and Israel is somehow comparable to what's playing out between the U.S. and Russia in a completely different war in a completely different environment and situation where Russia has nuclear weapons. So the whole thing is crazy. And I think they would say, oh, We didn't do anything you just said, Rich. The entire piece starts with the only factual part of the entire essay. I mean, everybody should read it. It's so crazy. Israel is a U.S. ally. Russia, a U.S. adversary. And then the whole piece goes on to just say Putin and Netanyahu are the same situation and Trump's not doing anything. So let's say, well, up front, you've already, you know, your whole up front is correct. They're not comparable, even if Israel hadn't given us a heads up. But they did. Of course they did. So it's even more unbelievable. But as you say, there's now reporting coming out during Rubio's trip for citing multiple Israeli officials, you know, basically saying, yeah, we would never move without Trump knowing. Of course he knew.
Yeah. Wow. Very bizarre from the Wall Street Journal. Well, that's all the time we have. So thank you so much for being here. It's been very interesting. And I know you've been talking a lot about humanitarian aid in Gaza and other topics lately, so we'll have to have you back again. Thank you for being here.
You bet.
Thank you for listening. And thank you to our producer, Yaniv Marzovsky. We will be on hiatus next week for Rosh Hashanah, but we will be back after that. So make sure to subscribe, like, and follow Misgav at www.misgavins.org and on social media, and send your comments, questions, and suggestions to Mideast Horizons Podcast at gmail.com. Shana Tovah.